Okay.
Today is the 26th.
From my understanding of ionic chemistry.
Yeah. My voice is almost gone, so I'm going to have to speak rather quietly. And I hope the people online can hear me, because I usually project a lot. But I think it was not teaching all summer, and then all of a sudden having four classes I have to teach in a week, and by Saturday I almost had no voice. I have a little more voice today, but I don't want to push it. So anyway, we're in the middle of explaining the origin of positivism, because, by the way, Tammy just joined. Tammy just joined.
Tammy
Alexander.
Hey, good morning. Hi. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Last week I forgot to look at all the squares, so I'm trying to figure out who was here last week, too, because I want to give full credit for people showing up. Well, anyway, what we're talking about is the origin of positivism, because, of course, where we're going with all this is we're going to examine William James. That's the object. I'm getting a little mileage out of this because I'm doing the same thing in one of my Ollie classes. So don't blame me for wanting to get some mileage out of this stuff. Marty is hearing some of this stuff twice.
Which is just as well.
Yeah. Anyway, because the practice arose in that context, and so 2 weeks ago, I began with Newton, because everything kind of goes back to Newton, really. I mean, Newton certainly was not a philosopher, but his Principia sort of set up the problems that philosophers would deal with. And remember, I said there were two sides to Newton, at least as far as we're concerned. You know, there's lots of things about Newton, but two things that we're interested in. One was the unprecedented application of mathematics to mechanics, you know, an area that heretofore had been investigated by casual observation and qualitative explanation, I would say. So that was one thing he did, and that brought to mind the possibility of increasing or setting up standards for all domains of human investigation. You know, maybe there should be standards out there. In other words, we don't just allow any old speculative theory to pop up. You know, we got to meet certain. There's got to be a bar there that you have to meet. And so that generalization, of course, was what the philosophers did, talking about not just mechanics, but any domain of human investigation. And then the negative side of Newton, I frame no hypotheses. Remember that. He wasn't going to speculate where there were no data really available about the cause of gravity. But once again, the philosophers generalized that, and what sorts of things then are unknowable for all time? Not just we don't happen to have data now, but they will never be knowable because they're in principle unknowable. That's the negative side of the whole thing. And so then that, even though Newton, as I say, was not a philosopher and was not formally a positivist, his suggestions or his hints or whatever you want to call them planted the seeds that would later germinate and flower into the movement known as positivism. Now, as I've said, the grandparents of positivism are humankind. I mean, in the 1930s, when the logical positivists were that was sort of their acme of influence was the 30s. They look back, and they look back to Hume and Kant as being the forerunners of their position. Of course, positivism then I defined as rough and ready definition, at least, as the idea that if something is knowable, it's knowable scientifically, and then reversing that. If something is not knowable scientifically, then it's just plain not knowable. And so I drew the circle. And the circle, not a very good circle. But let's pretend it's a circle. This represents the universe of knowledge. This represents the universe of knowledge, and of course, anything that's going to be inside this two circle has got to meet certain standards, is the idea. And anything outside the circle, of course, is in principle unknowable. Why are we bothering to ask those questions now, is the obvious question. Now, in order to make that more precise, you got to specify what it is that defines this circle. What is it that defines the boundaries of this circle? And once we can figure that out, then we can, first of all, explain what that bar is that we need to meet in any given domain of human investigation. But secondly, we can define what it is that goes out, that falls outside. Now, Tom, of course, as I last week I talked about it, and I'll mention it again. Tom asked a really good question at the end of class 2 weeks ago about, you know, well, this seems to exclude a lot. And he says, how about ethics, you know? And my answer that I gave in much more detail last week is, well, it depends on who you're talking about, really. Some positivists will draw that circle really narrowly and really strictly, and so all sorts of things fall outside. Other positivists will draw it in a more generous fashion. And, of course, where we're going with all this, William James, he's going to draw it so widely that he's not even going to look much like a positivist. But, I mean, that is his, that's technically, that's where he is, because he's a pragmatist, and pragmatism was simply an American offshoot of the positivistic tradition. I mean, you know, Peirce, the founder of pragmatism, started off as a Kantian. And so, let's see. Oh, we have... Oh, good. Laura and her parents are on. So Laura, J-A-P-P-E, look under that. She's on. And then you might also put a little note on the bottom saying Laura's parents. Because we want to count as many people as we possibly can, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
We gotta have bodies. And also Rick behind you. He's not even on the list, so write him
out. You got some quota numbers to hit, Don?
20. I want 20 a week. Be nice. We usually have 20. Back in the day, about 10 years ago, we had 30. A lot of the time. So, anyway, where was I? So, I began last week. I think it was last week. We started talking about Hume, and so. And what Hume is trying to do then is specify the criteria for defining the circle here. How is it, you know, how is it that, or what sorts of standards do we have to meet in various domains of human investigation? And remember, I said there are three in Hume, three. Two of which he's very clear on, and the third of which he's very fuzzy on, but it's really what he was trying to do. As I said last week, I understand what he was trying to do better than he understood what he was trying to do. But then again, I have almost three centuries of hindsight. You know, that helps a lot. So I can actually trisect this circle. And I'll do that. So I'll divide it up like I'm cutting a piece of pie. Because there are three different criteria that Hume gives for something being knowledge. And I'll quickly go over this because I went over most of it last week, but I want to talk about the third one, which is the one he's fuzzy on, but I'm clear on, and how revolutionary that is. You know. So the first two criteria, remember, are, well, a proposition can be a relation of ideas or a matter of fact. And a relation of ideas is simply a proposition whose truth we know, or falsity we know, because we understand the meanings of the words. And the example I gave, the standard example I give, a bachelor is unmarried, right? I don't have to go out and do a survey or anything like that. I know that it's true simply because I know the meaning of the word bachelor. I speak the English language. I know what that word means. And similarly, if I set up, there's one bachelor who's married, you'd know right off the bat that's false, because it doesn't make any sense to say that there's an unmarried male adult human who's married, right? So, I mean, the point is, some propositions are knowable just because of our language. And I also said that most positivists would put all of mathematics in that same category, although in mathematics, in mathematics we have really obvious propositions like the Bachelor one. I mean, if I say a triangle has three sides, you don't have to think very hard to know that's true. But if I say the sum of the angles of a triangle is equal to two right angles, well, that's not something you see immediately, but I can do a proof, I can construct a proof of it, each step being something you do understand immediately. So that falls under the same category as well. So I'll label one of these pie slices ROI. Okay? And then matters of fact are your standard empirically confirmable or disconfirmable propositions. So my example of last week, I think this is the one I used, is all bachelors are less than 100 years old, you know. Well, I can't tell just by examining the words whether that's true or false, but it's very clear how I could confirm it or disconfirm it when I wrote my email for... did you read my emails yet from last Friday?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, when I wrote it, I conjured this kind of science fiction scenario. Suppose we had a database of all people in the world that was updated in real time. Anytime a life event occurred, that database... Maybe people are wearing something, you know, like, who knows.
You mean like Facebook.
Yeah, except even more so. And, you know, so anytime a life event occurs, somebody's born, somebody dies, somebody gets married or whatever, boom, you know, the database is updated. And so then I could easily write a query, right? I could write a SQL query, an SQL query, and computers, SQL, SQL is one of the major database languages. So I could write a SQL query, select star from vital stats where sex equals male and age is greater than or equal to 100 and marital status equals unmarried. Right? And if I came up with zero, if I had no hits, then the proposition all bachelors are less than 100 years old would be true. But if I came up with one or more hits, then it would be false. So, but I mean, you know, obviously, that kind of thing, I go out and look. Right? I mean, it's purely empirical, a question of observation. Right? So that's the second MOF. All right. So those are the two that Hume is very, very clear on. But the third one is really the most interesting one, and I got into it last week. So let me just quickly go over as far as we got, but I'm going to take it a few steps further. The third one is comes out. It really applies to a lot of different propositions, of course, but it comes out of Hume's analysis of causation. And one of the attributes, or one of the things we mean by causation, is that the future will resemble the past. And so Hume asks, and, you know, duh, why didn't anybody think about asking that before? How do I know that the future will resemble the past? And he points out, well, first of all, it's not a relation of ideas, so I don't know it just because I know the English language, say. You know, so that's out. But second, I don't observe anything that tells me the future will resemble the past. All my observations are of the now. What's happening right now is nothing in there about the future. So I drop this magic marker 100 times and it falls, but how do I know that the 101st time it's not going to, you know, go up or something like that, or explode or disappear, or, you know, something like that? I don't. I certainly expect the future to resemble the past. There's no question about that. I expect it to. But then Hume says that the belief that the future will resemble the past is not rational. And that's where we get into trouble, problems of interpretation. What does he mean by saying it's not rational? Well, Hume, you know, had this personality quirk, right? Keep on complaining about that. He was a little vain. He knew he was really, really smart. And because of that, he kind of liked to shock people, kind of liked to shock his reader. And so he tends to really hard pedal these seemingly paradoxical conclusions because he knows he can defend it and all that sort of thing. So the casual reader you know, reading what Hume said, he doesn't put it quite as baldly as I did, but almost, you know, the future will resemble the past is not rational. Of course, the casual reader is going to say, you mean to tell me, David Hume, that I shouldn't believe the future, or that either the future won't resemble that, or that I shouldn't believe that it'll come on. You know, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But that's not really what Hume means, but his language often opens him up to that misinterpretation. What he really means comes out mostly, I pointed out, by the way, you know, how his language isn't even, he's all over the place in terms of terminology here. Right, I mean, when we're doing relations of ideas and matters of fact, those are two technical expressions that he devises, that he uses over and over and over again. They have a rather clear meaning. He understands what they mean, and it's just no problem there. We get it the whole way through. But I pointed out, look at this list. Look at this. It's crazy. This other thing, he's all over the place. Sometimes he calls it custom. Sometimes he calls it habit. Sometimes he calls it belief. Sometimes he calls it feeling. Sometimes he calls it instinct. So clearly he didn't have a set idea of really what he wanted to say there. If he had, he would have had a phrase, kind of like the other two. Well, I circled instinct because the location where that, well, maybe not the only place, but the main place where that term pops up is in his wonderful chapters. I think they're great. In both the Treatise of Human Nature and the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding of the Reason of Animals. And that is so phenomenal, especially in the 18th century, that any philosopher would even take animals seriously. Descartes, for example, the great Descartes, had literally thought that animals were nothing more than machines. I also stressed the same idea in my Bentham class on Friday. Bentham, also, somewhat later, has this wonderful footnote in his Principles of Morals and Legislation, talking about, you might say, the rights of animals. You know, he's saying, what's really relevant, because utilitarians are all hedonists. For utilitarians, pleasure and pain are the main things we need to worry about. Well, obviously, animals can feel pain. So at the very end of this footnote, you know, he says, well, you know, the relevant question is not whether they can think or whether they can talk, but whether they can suffer. And so we might say have obligations to animals. So Bentham and Hume both are rather unique, I think, in the 18th century in really taking animals seriously. And so what does Hume say? Well, Hume says in these wonderful chapters, one in each of the two books, animals expect the future to resemble the past. You beat a dog with a stick, the next time you see that dog, that dog's not going to be your best friend. You know that. Why? Well, because the dog sees you and thinks, enemy, and probably going to do the same thing today that he did yesterday, say, something like that. The dog behaves as though it expects the future to resemble the past. You teach a rat to run a maze. You put the rat at the entrance. Once the rat has learned how to go through the maze, you put the rat at the maze entrance. The rat recognizes it. Implicitly, the rat is going to expect that maze to look just like it did yesterday when that rat ran through it. And then, as I said, I think I said this last time, the most amazing thing, apparently you can even teach flatworms to run mazes. So flatworms expect the future to resemble the past too. What does that mean? Well, if I can quote Bob Creveling, when we were talking about Kant at the time, I think this is many, 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 many years ago, but was he a chemist or a biologist? He was a biologist, right? At NIH? Isn't
yeah, it? I think so.
I think so.
Or some combination
of
the two.
Yeah, right. He used the word hardwired. Somehow, the expectation the future will resemble the past is hardwired in apparently all animals. Heck, if flatworms expect the future to resemble the past. And Hume's point, remember, Hume was saying the expectation that the future resemble the past is not rational. But his point is, in bringing up animals, is, well, you know, animals have no concepts of relations of ideas or of matters of fact. Animals don't perform deductive or inductive reasoning the way we do because of our big brains. You know, we can do all that sort of stuff. But animals, they don't do that. And yet animals do expect the future to resemble the past. So that's what I mean, basically, by saying that it's not rational. It's not something that that's resident in our cerebral cortex, the part of our big brains that where we do all this reasoning and that sort of thing. It's not there at all. It's hardwired at a much more basic level, or brainstem or something. I don't know. But something that we have in common with flatworms, whatever that is, right? So that's why I like his word instinct. Because for animals, it would seem that the expectation of the future would resemble the past. I mean, I think we might be inclined to call that an instinct. But Hume's point is, we have instincts too. We're human. We have instincts too. We're not just totally rational beings. We've got a lot in common with animals, and one of the examples of that, only one, but there are many, many others, but one of them is the expectation that the future will resemble the past. I'm going to read you. I only brought my book in because it's simpler. I pulled out a bunch of the passages here that are really, but I want to read you four sentences that I pulled out of context and just abutted to one another. And I want you to do a little thought experiment. Pretend that you don't know who wrote these sentences. Pretend you just come into the room and I opened the book and I started reading these sentences and then asked you the question, who do you think wrote those sentences? Now let me read the sentences and then just pretend the veil, what do you call it, the willful suspension of disbelief. Pretend that you don't know who wrote them. And I've put in a few words to make it run smoothly, but these are almost all direct quotes. Because it has been so necessary to the subsistence of our species, custom has effected a kind of pre-established harmony between the course of nature and the succession of our ideas. Because this operation of the mind is so essential to the subsistence of all human creatures, nature has implanted in us an instinct which carries forward the thought in a correspondent course to that which she has established among natural objects. Now, if I read those, if I came into this room and read you those sentences, and I said, who do you think wrote those sentences? Any takers?
Yogi Berra?
Well, I haven't thought of that one.
Charles Darwin?
Yeah, I would think that's the answer that I would have given, I think. Because, you know, there's all this talk about nature has implanted this instinct in us so that what we think happens to correspond with the way things are out there. So surely, it's obvious from these sentences that Hume is by no means saying we shouldn't believe the future will resemble the past. And he also, obviously, is really saying that's probably the way it really is. In fact, that's why nature has effected that. Because otherwise our species would have perished. Doesn't that sound Darwinian? Right? It sounds Darwinian. Natural selection has ensured that the beliefs that we are somehow born with match, in some cases, match the way the world really is. Because if it didn't, we wouldn't still be here. Way on back, you might say. Some flatworm. Some flatworm had some genetic mutation and all of its siblings and cousins didn't have this mutation. It never occurred to them the future would resemble the past. But this one flatworm has got this mutation, and it now thinks the future will resemble the past, and it could absolutely outcompete any of its siblings or its cousins, and its progeny span the globe.
John, can I ask a question?
Thanks, Grandpa. Yes?
But your buddy Aristotle wouldn't have... I mean, he knew that animals had some kind of instincts. Did mm-hmm. he just not comment on that?
Well, I mean, Aristotle has...
In an argument of future resembles the past, because that's pretty pithy.
Yeah.
But he would have said that animals have instincts.
Of course. I mean, humans drawing on what you might say common belief, we always say animals have instincts. Sure. He talks about birds, for example, and stuff like that. And Aristotle certainly knew humans have instincts. And to Aristotle's credit, or eventually the ancient Greeks' credit, well, actually, I could even quote, I haven't read it yet. Can I take this home? Because I won't have time to read it before.
I need it.
Oh, okay, okay.
I'll try to scan the PDF and send it.
Yeah, do that. Yeah, do that. Okay. Well, anyway, the title of that is Aristotle,
it's short.
Animal philosophers.
All right. Yeah.
What's that?
And Aristotle was very much sees us as continuous with the animal creation too. That was typical in ancient philosophy. I mean, one of the things that, sad to say, even though I admire Gregory Nyssa very much, sad to say, the idea that humans and humans alone were created in the image of God went the other direction. I mean, Aristotle sees humans as continuous. It's a continuum, really. That's really all it is. But when you start saying, well, only humans are created in the image of God and everybody, all the other creatures out there are not, then that sort of breaks the continuum and puts us here and everything else here. And one of the side effects of that is, well, we need to revere our human duties to one another, but the animals down here, they're just to be used. And Descartes thinks of them as machines, as I said. I don't know. Am I answering your question? Or probably I got off the subject.
I'm trying to get my arms around what's considered the great insight here.
Of Hume?
Besides, you know, with respect to animals. One is, you said, he's giving animals respect.
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. That they're more like humans than maybe you want to give them credit for.
Like Bentham says. Yeah.
Which is not really a statement of human philosophy.
What do you mean?
Because you're saying that, you're comparing animals to humans, not humans to animals, really.
Well, I really haven't gotten to the main point yet, you're asking what's... I mean, yeah. The point I was making earlier was simply a sort of historical point, that it's rather unusual in the 18th century to put so much emphasis on animals.
Okay.
And I've contrasted that with Descartes.
All right.
Let me just see if anybody else... No, I guess not. I'm trying to keep track of... Yeah.
Yes, could I ask on... You said something about if they can suffer, then that's a different thing. So does that mean we're not supposed to step on ants that are crawling across our floor and kill them that way?
Yeah, you're quoting... I mean, that was when I was quoting Bentham. And I don't know... do insects feel pain? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that they do. And I think Bentham was certainly thinking about what we call the higher animals... which obviously can suffer. We can tell that they can feel pain and pleasure. The reason this is astounding, it really is astounding, I haven't really said this yet, is that Hume, although he's an empiricist, is directly contradicting, as I put it in my email, Article 1 of the Empiricist Creed. And, we pointed this out last week, didn't we? No, that was my other class. Never mind, I'm getting old. Article 1 of the Empiricist Creed is, in the words of John Locke, at birth the mind is a tabula rasa, a blank tablet, right? And that, even though Aristotle didn't, I mean, that doesn't come from Aristotle, it comes from Locke. Yes, Jay?
Say that again. I didn't
At birth, the mind is a blank tablet.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Like the Romantic poets.
Yeah. Aristotle didn't write those words, but Aristotle basically would say the same. He would agree with Locke. The empiricist tradition thought that way, that if it's a question of nature and nurture, nurture is 100%. At birth, the mind is a blank tablet. Experience writes on that tablet, and that's where our knowledge comes from. So in the contest between nature and nurture, it's everything's on one side and zero on the other side. 100% nurture, 0% nature was the picture. Well, that's exactly what Hume is contradicting. He's saying at birth there is writing on that tablet. One of the sentences written on that tablet is, the future will resemble the past. That is astonishing. And so here we saw, and if you think about it, it seems so obvious in retrospect. Heck, I mean, if our genetic inheritance is responsible for the fact that I have four limbs and five digits on each limb, for example, and all the other things, why in the world would our neural structure also not be affected by our genetic inheritance? Seems obvious it would be. Of course, looking back, it seems obvious. It wasn't obvious in the 18th century. That's why Hume is a pioneer. And, by the way, one little other footnote, even though Hume says that the belief the future will resemble the past is not rational, you could create a perfectly right. Yeah, Rick.
You might be getting to this point,
yeah.
But under Hume, then, why would people choose to do something differently than another person? Whatever that thing is.
Oh, well, I mean, he's not saying...
Whatever that action is...
I guess I see what you're saying. Well, he's not a determinist. I mean, he's not saying that we can't help but act when I raise my hand, that's somehow not my free will. He's not going that far. But he is saying that certain expectations, for example, that there are objects out there, that's another one that he mentions, but not in as much detail. Those kinds of expectations are hardwired, to use Bob's phrase, in our brains. And so that, in turn, as I said, could give you a rational argument that the future would resemble the past or that physical objects exist, the rational argument being, if we were wrong, we wouldn't be here. Looking at it in a Darwinian way. And that's why all our great-granddaddy flatworm siblings and cousins all died out, because they did not expect the future to resemble the past. I think in my book, I tell this little thought experiment, or somewhere, I wrote it, I'm not sure where. And I said, well, imagine this is 40,000 years ago, and I'm living in a cave, and yesterday my brother was eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And unfortunately, I was born with this mutation where I did not expect the future to resemble the past, and today I encounter a saber-toothed tiger. And it never dawns on me that what happened to my brother yesterday has any bearing on my situation today. I would not be able to pass those genes on to the next generation. Right.
On the contrary, you didn't get the advice there was a tiger yesterday. Your brother did, so you didn't have that experience.
Yeah, but it's easily. Yeah, but it's. But the thing to be, it's not just me. It's somebody like me had that same experience, and it's generalizable to all, right? You could also modify the example too and say, yesterday I barely escaped the saber-toothed tiger, and today I run into one again. But. Anyway, that's the idea. Go ahead.
I guess it gets too far off the beaten path, but some rats will take longer to learn the maze than other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Some dogs can be trained a lot quicker than other ones. So there's a level somehow, or a sophistication that exists to a greater or lesser degree.
True. And some humans can be trained faster than others too, right? So, but I mean, that's a separate issue from the expectation the future will resemble the past. Right? So, anyway, The implicit rejection of the empiricist creed, or Article 1, as I said, of the empiricist creed, that at birth the mind is a tabula rasa, is what's really, really amazing here. But the closest Hume ever came, as I say, Hume is not nearly as clear as I am on what he wants to say. And, you know, this is a third criterion, right? That's how I am advertising this. It's a third criterion in addition to the one, two he's clear on. The closest he ever comes to saying it the way I'm saying, and it's not that close, but it's as close as it gets, is a paragraph in the treatise. And let me read you that paragraph. So this is as close as he gets, and this is what he says. In order to justify myself, I must distinguish in the imagination betwixt the principles which are permanent, irresistible, and universal, such as the customary transition from causes to effects and from effects to causes, and the principles which are changeable, weak, and irregular. The former are the foundation of all our thoughts and actions, so that upon their removal, human nature must immediately perish and go to ruin. The latter are neither unavoidable to mankind, nor necessary, nor so much as useful in the conduct of life, but on the contrary, are observed only to take place in weak minds, and being opposite to other principles of custom and reasoning, may easily be subverted by a due contrast and opposition. For this reason, the former are received by philosophy, and the latter rejected. That's as close as he comes to saying that we have a third criterion, and I'm going to call it instinctive beliefs. So, of course, that's what I call it. But he doesn't have a phrase like that. But that's as close as he comes. So, now I can fill in the third pie slice. Let's see. CHBFI. Try to pronounce that. So that's the way it looks. So now we have succeeded in defining what this circle looks like. We have succeeded in specifying the criteria for some things being inside the circle, and then it turns out then I now can say what it is that's outside the circle, since I have a clear idea of what's inside the circle. Anything that is neither a relation of ideas, a matter of fact, or an instinctive belief is going to fall outside the circle. The question Tom asked the other day about, does it include ethics? For Hume, ethics is inside the circle, actually, and so is for Kant as well. But now you'll see what's outside the circle.
Can I ask a question that might be at the wrong time? And that is,
sure.
What you described as the third one is a form of induction.
But it's
are you going to get all the inductive reasoning you can do, like try to go from the specific to the general,
right,
which is not human behavior, but is how all that inductive reasoning, is it in your wedge, or you're not going to get to that?
The inductive reasoning you're talking about, a lot of it. Well, you got to separate, you got to distinguish the application of the idea of the future will resemble the past, which we do all the time. We observe that this set of elephants have trunks, and so all is inductive reasoning. Right? The application of it from the principle itself is here, but the application of it, at least the data that it's based on, are over there.
Well, there are matters of fact that you can prove, and others that are assertions from, you know, research, and, you know, like, let's just say, well, there's no life on other planets, right? People will assert that as a matter of fact, but it's not proven.
That may be okay. Here we have to distinguish the idea of verifiable in principle from verifiable in fact. I mean, if we think that something can be confirmed in principle at some future date, maybe, we don't have the data right now, but we think that there's no reason to suspect that down the road we won't be able to tell. That's okay. That's over here.
Right, so there's quite a bit of stuff in there.
Yeah, it's not necessarily just everything we happen to know right now. It's anything that we think, we could be wrong, but we think can be confirmed or disconfirmed empirically. Goes here. But if it's in principle unconfirmable here, here, or here, it's here.
Okay.
Yeah. So then if we focus on what's outside the circle, that's the second half of things. I'm just going to quote the famous last paragraph from Hume's inquiry. This is what he says. This is really famous. When we run over our libraries, persuaded of these principles, what havoc must we make? If we take in our hands, say, any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? That would be relations of ideas. No. Does it contain any experimental reason concerning matter of fact and existence? No. And then if I can interpolate, does it contain anything about instinctive beliefs? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. That's the famous last sentence of the inquiry concerning human understanding. Now, let's parse it a little bit. The very first part of that sentence, if we take in our hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, what does he mean by divinity? What's that word mean in the 18th century?
Divinity.
So like the school of divinity, I mean, it's just an old-fashioned term for theology. School metaphysics, what would that refer to, do you think? What was that? No? Well, yes, but which? With the emphasis on the word school. In the 18th century, when you talk about the schools, what do you think he would be referring to?
Scholastic.
Yes, that's right.
What'd you say?
Scholastic.
Yeah. We talk about the scholastic period in philosophy and theology. We're talking about the era of Thomas Aquinas and that general 100 years on either side, say. In the 13th century, where you wanted to be, if you wanted to be on the cutting edge, was in the schools. The University of Paris, say, or University of Oxford, someplace like that. That was the cutting edge. But, of course, by the time you get to the 18th century, Hume century, the schools were very sclerotic. I mean, they hadn't changed a bit. They were still, mentally, back in the 13th century. And, of course, 13th century philosophy was meshed with theology. That's a fact. The great philosophers of the scholastic period were also theologians. So basically what Hume is saying is, if we take into our hands any volume of religious literature, commit it to the flames, for it contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. That's what he's saying. That's why positivism represents a challenge for religion, because religion falls outside here. And if you look at the chapters of the inquiry, for example, where he is talking about religion, or talking about the things that will fall outside, for example, one was on free will. Well, that's a very important theological question. One is on the existence of God, it's another one. And one is on miracles. So clearly, in Hume's mind, everything that's outside this circle is connected somehow with religion, somehow. And by the way, it will be similar in Kant. But it doesn't exclude ethics. Now, of course, the logical positivists, the ones in the 1930s, they take this circle and they shrink it even more, and ethics winds up outside there too. But we're talking about Hume and Kant. For them, they're in the middle somewhere. Now, of course, William James, he's going to go the other direction.
So he would claim that Muhammad was a liar.
Probably, yeah.
Or the witnesses to Jesus' miracles.
Oh, yes.
It's all made up.
Oh, yes.
All those people are either wrong or lying.
Yeah.
To be harsh.
Yep, that's right. As a matter of fact, as far as miracles go, he would say that because we expect the future to resemble the past and it's part of our brainstem, and a miracle is an exception to that expectation, that as a matter of fact, nobody really does believe in miracles. People just fool themselves into thinking they do. So, well, that's a good stopping place. I'm like 1 minute shy, but I got to run down, and because I'm got roped into playing a portion of Dueling Banjos this morning. I guess, yeah, I thank everybody. We got everybody who's on. So, yeah. So we'll pick up with Kant then next week, and then we'll go on to Peirce and Jane. So, wherever that's. Yeah. See you all.
Thanks, Don. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Don.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
can
put
in,
I guess,
he's
doing, like, later. You can put other places.
Okay.
Religion is a